You give the model that attacked Minako the karmic fate upgrade, and that just says whenever Minako would take damage, the model with the upgrade also takes the same amount of damage.
Oh, nice. Howdy, friends. Boy, we got a treat for you. This Asami Deep Dive has some incredible insights from two very top players. And I'll tell you, if you don't play Asami, you are going to learn something from this episode, cover a lot of things. We discover what a flexible master she is. We're going to learn when summoning may not be the best move. You'll be a little bit surprised with the first model they hire after the totem. Their take on flicker bombing might surprise you. Greg makes an argument for using Terracotta Warriors in an Oni crew, and I know a lot of people don't think Terracotta Warriors really have found a home yet. They both have their main builds, but they both have some very interesting alternate builds that we really dig into. At the very end, we talk about Shenlong and all the chatter around that master and how people that ran him performed at UK Nationals. That's definitely worth sticking around for. Last but not least, you may have noticed that I've started leaving outtakes at the very end of each episode. So let me know in the comments on Facebook if you like having those there. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Greg here on the Third Floor. Today we're going to do a deep dive into the Ten Thunders Master Asami Tanaka and how the Oni crew works in Malifaux 3rd Edition. My guests today are Alex Drake and Greg Pakash. Anyone that has heard our McCabe deep dive already knows Alex, and he recently finished 4th at the UK Nationals event. So Alex, welcome back to the Third Floor.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Craig. It's great to be here again.
So can you give me kind of a couple sentences on how the UK Nationals felt?
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. Best event of the year, some would say. Yeah. Seven games, seven great opponents, 86 people, I think we had this time.
It's amazing. No,
really, really good. Just to see that many tables in a hall and that many people playing a game is really inspiring.
So. Yeah, I bet. So you guys on the first day play 4 games, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm playing in a grand tournament or even a regular tournament, after the end of round 3, like my brain is fried. How do you put together enough to get like clear thinking for a 4th game?
I think clear thinking goes out the window. on the Saturday we did 3 games in a row, the last 3 games. So by the 4th game, you're just sort of trying to go on autopilot, really.
Yeah,
it's an endurance sport at that point.
It really is, because I mean, it's just so mentally exhausting.
Yeah, you get into it actually, though, and sometimes by the end of the day, you're sort of like, yeah, well, let's play again. Where's my 5th game?
That's when the adrenaline kicks in.
Yeah, let's take it to the pub. Let's play another game.
That's funny. my other guest is Greg, and this is actually his first appearance on the podcast, but many of you probably already know his name. He held the top spot during M2E in the UK rankings for over 12 straight months, which is impressive. He took a short break from Malifaux, but he's back for this new edition, and some of you might recognize him because he did the Lilith Master Spotlight on Schemes and Stones back in M2E. So Greg, welcome to the Third Floor, man.
Hey, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me. It's a little bit weird to be back, but we've got a really good game to play. So,
now having left and come back, and having a couple months now, what's your feelings about 3rd edition versus 2nd?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's weird how streamlined the game feels, considering there's nothing being taken out of it from a model point of view, which I know it's not exactly true because of Dead Man's Hand and things like that. But when you consider how many models are in Dead Man's Hand compared to how many we've got left, the fact that you're playing a game that just seems to work so much better. And second was still a superb game. I mean, I'm coming from all the way from 1.5. And when we initially made the transition to second, we only played with half a game for over a year. Masters like Jackdaw wasn't a master, but I suppose we didn't have no Molly, for example, no Colette, no Dreamer. Masters like that didn't exist. Well, they did, but they had no second edition rules. And so, yeah, our first game was our first year was played with only maybe three Masters of Faction, I think, if I remember correctly, including kind of a Ten Thunders once. So yeah,
that's crazy.
This is it's good. It's good.
I know what you're saying, though. Yeah, and I know what you're saying about it. It's funny how streamlined it feels because, like, the first time I read the third edition rules, I was like, okay, there's some nice little tweaks here, nice little tweaks there. But until I actually started playing, I didn't realize what a huge impact it had on how the game felt.
Yeah, absolutely massive. And a lot of things, even just it sounds such a simple thing, but we have the same effect, we'll have the same name or the same ability, even whether it's on a Neverborn card or an Outcast card, and just little things like that. Again, especially if you're a newer player coming into the game, where it's like, oh, you know, I've got, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a word now, Disguised, though that was a bad example, but because it was the same in M2E, no matter who you were. But at least then you know what that ability does, and like, oh, you play another crew that you've never played before. And it said, oh, well, this person's got XYZ ability. Like, oh, well, okay, I know what two of those do already. Right, excellent. That's, you know, what's the third?
Exactly.
Yeah, just little things, but it adds up to a lot.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. No, I completely agree. So, guys, what I want to do is I want to focus on, obviously, Asami and the Oni crew, and I want to really get a sense of how you guys build an Oni crew, how the crew plays, if there's any tech pieces in the crew that you bring in based off of, you know, the strategy or certain schemes. And we also want to cover how to counter this crew. So, Alex, let's pretend that somebody listening right now has never played Asami, never played against Asami, hasn't even read the card. Can you kind of give us an overview of the style of Master that Asami is?
Yeah, so she's a really, really flexible summoning Master, able to summoning... summon in Oni to sort of fit the situation at the time. So she can summon in quite sort of aggressive big beaters or sort of like scheming or support pieces. And she does that to fit the situation and fit what sort of like your opponent's doing to sort of either put pressure on them or to answer what they're doing.
So flexible summoner.
Yeah, flexible summoner. I think some would say like aggressive summoner with some of the positioning and with the flicker mechanic that I'm sure we'll get into. But yeah, maybe aggressive flexible summoner, I think is how I'd class her. To someone that's never heard of her or is sort of like coming to her sort of afresh.
Yeah, just to add to what Alex said, that she's a phenomenally flexible summoner, but. Due to kind of the nature of her keyword and how our summons work, which we'll get into in a bit, she also has to then effectively support her models, which is where I think a lot of the kind of aggressive summoner thing comes from. Is that she needs to be close to her models for her summons to be effective in a fairly roundabout way, which again, there's a little bit of foreshadowing, but we'll get into. It's not so much that she herself summons and then is aggressive. It's that she needs to play forward to continually support her summoned models. It's not kind of not exactly a fire and forget type of mechanic. There's a lot of additional aftercare.
Right. And so, which is going to bring her up, right? And in order to do that support. So, Greg, let's jump right into that, though. So, because her summoning is very unique and this flicker mechanic is very unique. Do you mind walking through kind of how she summons and what flicker means?
Yeah, certainly. So in terms of how she summons, Asami has this beautiful ability to summon without any form of resource. She doesn't need any markers down. All you need is a mask card of a high enough value, depending on what you wish to summon. Now, the downside of that, the way it's kind of balanced around is that, like many other summoners, she gives her models an upgrade when it summons. And part of the text on that upgrade states that when a model summoned, it gains 2 flicker tokens, which we'll get to in a second. And when that model, at the end of that model's activation, it gains another flicker token. Now, flicker herself, that's part of her keyword. I think the actual keyword itself ability is called From Beyond. But flicker is what you as an Asami player or Asami opponent will interact with. And so basically what this says is before you perform a duel, you can give a model a flicker token. And that flicker token basically works like focus. You gain a positive to the flip of a duel, and you gain a positive to any resulting damage flip. Now, if you, at the end of any model's activation, so your own, friendly, enemy, whatever, if you have, or a model has 3 or more flicker tokens on it, and then it is killed, it disappears.
Got it.
The whole kind of flicker mechanic is... It's. I'm not sure if I'm going to explain this correctly, but there's this kind of Japanese saying called "mono no ware," which I've probably butchered the pronunciation of. But that basically is like a sensitivity or an appreciation of impermanence, which is a lot of what her crew's about. I think in English, the closest thing we might have is like the candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long.
Nice.
So you know the flicker mechanic lets you accelerate, but you won't be around that long. And going back to her summoning upgrades, when you summon in, you know, you automatically gain 2 flicker. At the end of that model's activation, it's going to get a 3rd, which means it's only going to last 1 turn, as opposed to other summoners where, you know, a model you summon on turn 1 could easily be around in, you know, turn 4 or 5.
Right.
Unless, again, we go to some of the aftercare we talked about, which I might let Alex talk about instead. You're only going to have your summon model around for the 1 turn.
But there's obviously ways, and we're going to get into it, that you can mitigate that, I would assume. So, Alex, you know, I would imagine, you know, part of the art of running this crew is really being able to manage that flicker, right?
Yeah, managing your flicker is huge, actually. It's really where you're going to squeeze out the best of the crew. You know, you can be, because you can just simply summon an Oni, summon a demon, put it down, and you know it's only going to last 1 activation. It's not slow, it's not stunned, it just goes in, and you gain the flicker to get focuses on its attacks, and you can have sort of a really, like Greg said, a really brightly burning summon. But then your other options are maybe trying to keep it around an extra turn. Do I summon it and I get to place it next to some scrap or corpse markers? So when you summon it and it's within an inch of scrap or corpse, you can remove each one to lessen the flicker that it's gained upon. Do I try and use some of her other abilities to reduce the flicker after it's summoned? You know, to sort of try and keep that model alive for longer. And I think that really is the balance that you're looking at when you're playing the crew. You know, you're going in hard, or you're trying to keep them alive for longer. And that's what I find that really, really interesting. I think so the main way she's managing the flicker is probably with a Mother's Love, which is it's a tactical action, range 8. So that's where she needs to be, a little bit up the board in range of those summons and in range of her crew. She needs a four to cast it. Targets an Oni, and it discards a flicker from them and gives them focus. So you could sort of see this as maybe giving them two focuses,
sure,
or 2 APs worth, you know, sort of. But you're removing the flicker to keep them alive, and then you're giving them a focus for a further action. And I'll often be using this on my models just to keep them below that. To keep them down to 1 flicker, maybe, so that they survive maybe the next turn, or depending on the situation. But that's the decision you're making. The other way she manages the flicker is when a friendly Oni ends its activation within 10 of her, she can suffer 2 damage to remove a flicker token from that model. So if your opponent's sort of thinking that it's going to die at the end of its activation, and then Asami will take 2 damage to remove it and keep it alive, and that can be a bit of a key a key way of keeping your models on the board, but you can't overuse it because it's the life of your master. She's also got a trigger on a summon, so it's on a crow. So if you are summoning, you know, you're going to need a mask and a crow for it. So you're stoning for one of them and having the card for the other, and that's that she could suffer any amount of damage and reduce the flicker on the summon model by the amount of damage she suffers. So, you know, you can use a 13 of masks, you can stone for the crow, you can summon a Jorogumo, she could take two wounds and it comes into play on no flicker, which is impactful, because then it can have two, you know, it can have a focused attack on its turn and not have to worry about disappearing.
But I mean, boy, you got to be smart about all of that, don't you? I mean, there's a lot to balance there, which is not putting too much damage on her, because she's not going to be hiding, you know, in the back of your deployment zone while this is all happening. And two, you know, deciding whether, you know, that corpse and scrap marker is in the right place where you need the model to be, or do you need to summon it somewhere else that it's not going to have that? I mean, Greg, that seems like a lot of finesse.
Yeah, certainly. It's one of my kind of, I suppose, key tenets that I've developed when playing her, is that you need to plan at least one turn ahead, because you've got, as you said, you've got flicker to manage, you have Sammy's wounds to manage, you have the different ways of, and then the different ways of managing those, whether it's a Sammy's abilities, you know, picking up scrap markers from the summon. Asami can also use scrap scheme and course markers to heal herself. So you're kind of juggling her wounds, you're juggling flicker, you're using different resources to manage the flicker and manage her wounds. It's worth saying as well that the actual Oni models themselves, when they kill an enemy model, they can also remove a flicker from themselves. So you've kind of got that risk analysis. You know, when you've got a model on two flicker, it's do you spend for the third to go in for the kill, hoping that you could then take another flicker off. If that model dies, there's a lot going on inside that keyword. It's one of the reasons I adore it so much. No matter what game no matter how the game's going, for you it's interesting, right? Because there's always other little bits and pieces going on in the background.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not a, you know, a plug and play master. I mean, that is obvious. And depending, I would imagine, the kind of player you are, that's what can make her attractive, because the flexibility she brings is huge. But you can't, I mean, you just got a lot to think about. And that's, like I said, that's okay. She's one of the several 10 Thunders masters that I find incredibly interesting. So, Greg, my next question about that, though, is, so we're playing her forward. We're really doing our best to manage how much damage she's taking to try to keep her stuff standing. Is there other things that are keeping her on the board? Is there any defensive tech she has? Is there any healing she's getting? I mean, what prevents her from going from 12 to no wounds in two turns?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of defensive tech, she's base defense 6, which is, you know, already pretty decent, already up there. She could also, and I'm going to forget the name, she can pass off attacks to Oni.
Protected.
You know, everyone's got, oh, not everyone. Protected, that's the word. Hers is protected Oni. Again, it's going to cost you a card, which for a summoning model is, summoning master can be expensive. Depending on a particular situation. And she can also, she has a bonus action where she can remove corpse, scrap, or scheme markers to heal 2 per marker removed.
Also, the summon model gets flicker at the start of their activation.
But where it matters, though, Alex, is what happens at the end of the activation, right? Yeah. So, and I think I already know the answer to this. Like, if it doesn't matter if it has 3 or 6 flicker at the end of the activation, the same thing happens.
Yeah, there's absolutely no upper cap.
Yeah. Alex, I want to talk a little bit. I mean, boy, I mean, you have a lot of pressure on her 3 AP because, you know, except for the bonus action to heal herself, you know, she's using an AP to summon. She's using an AP to potentially remove some flicker. But it looks like she has some decent attack actions, one that even has an execute trigger. Do you find yourself using those attack actions, or is she really tied up kind of keeping the crew up and running?
I do find myself using the attack actions. It probably this is probably a bit different from some of your other people's experiences, but maybe more than the summon. The summon is when, you know, when you've got the cards or when you need the models for specific situations. But actually, the two attack actions she's got are really useful. So the melee attack, another mouth to feed. You know, it's stat 6, which is good. But you're looking at 2, 4, 6 damage
so
track.
Good.
And like you said, the execute trigger. So you can sort of later game when someone's running out of resources with their stones, it's late in a turn, someone's running out of the cards, and you go in with a couple of executes on something, it can be quite swingy. So it just means she's got a bit of protection. People have to think maybe twice before going into her as heavy as they would.
Yeah, that offensive capability becomes its own defensive tech.
Yeah, it just persuades people to maybe stay away a little bit.
Yeah.
The other one, reaching tendrils, is really, really useful. So it is a projectile, but it's stat 6, ignores friendly fire, and it just pushes the target 6 inches. There's a couple of triggers on it, but to be honest, I don't really get very much use out of them because their triggers, they're rip and tear and coordinated attack, so they're mainly for if you're pushing enemies. But a lot of the time I'm pushing friendlies around with reaching tendrils. Just with a hair, pushing a friendly model 6 inches is really, really impactful. You know, if you, for that flexibility, it gives that crew the speed and the ability to respond
right
on the board where you need it to.
Well, and we've talked about it so many times here on the podcast that especially in third edition, positioning is everything. Almost every single thing you do to score has to do about where your model is on the board. So any type of ways to push your own models or even be able to push your opponent's models, I mean, the more you play the game, the more you realize how powerful that is.
Yeah, exactly. It's really we'll get into schemes later on, but it's really good for denying certain schemes or trying to guarantee yourself that some of those points. So it's really, really important for that point scoring. Doesn't feel as flashy as summoning something huge and hitting them. Doesn't feel as flashy as going in and executing someone, pushing someone 6 inches. But if it gets you the points, that's what the game's about, really.
Yeah, well, and 6 inches is a big deal. I mean, with so many of the pushes we see out there are 2-inch pushes, 3-inch pushes. A 6-inch push is a lot. The last thing I think it's worth mentioning before we take a break is the fact that she has built-in arcane reservoir. which is a good thing, right?
Yeah, and she needs it. Well, yeah, maybe she doesn't need it, but I appreciate it. You know, she's a summoner. The 7 cards is, you know, means you're more likely to get the ones you want. And actually, maybe we'll get onto this at some point, but there is quite a bit of pressure on the crew for cards, or I find there is. So the 7 cards is really.
So Greg, when you're building an Oni crew, out of curiosity, how stone hungry is that crew? I mean, how many stones do you like to have in your cache?
One of the kind of core Asami crews I tend to run, I have 9. I run quite heavy.
I can see that.
That 9 tends to frequently actually drop, well, anywhere between 5 and 9. You know, if I'm in a matchup and I kind of feel that I need a particular upgrade, you know, dropping down to 7 is not too bad. If I feel I might need a particular tech piece or particular support piece and that's going to cost me a couple of extra stones to swap a model out or add a new one, and I dropped, you know, 5 or 6. It's not too big a deal, mainly because I'm trying to trade off, you know, what I might spend those stones on during the game for an ability which I'm going to use all game long. It's more of a meta call than anything else.
Right, exactly. Well, guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, what I want to do is I want to focus more on what models Greg and Alex are bringing in to their Oni crew. So we're going to talk about building a crew. We'll be right back.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
So now that we got kind of a feeling of really, which I think makes Asami just a cool master and Oni a cool keyword. What I'd like to do is get a sense from these guys. What are, when they're building a crew, and despite whatever the pool is, the strategy is, regardless of what the opponent is, are there models that they just always hire? Obviously, we'll start with the totem, but what are some other models that just always seem to make it into the crew? And then let's get into the summons a little bit. So, Alex, let's talk about the totem. Can you give me an idea of what Asami's totem does?
Yeah, so he's a bit of a support totem. He can remove flicker and potentially on the trigger, he can remove conditions. So he tends to follow around some of the Oni and maybe remove flicker from them just to keep them alive a little bit longer, allowing them to get those positives flipped to their attacks or their defensive jewels. So he tends to be a little bit of a support totem. He can put up, as he's quick action, he can put up an aura of concealment, which comes in handy because you've got to remember we are, when we're staying in keyword, we're a very melee centric crew. We're not a ranged crew really.
Got you.
I suppose one really interesting thing about him is that if, he's got an ability, the true power, and that's when, if you lose Asami in the game, when she dies, you get to attach an upgrade to him. And it just makes him a bit of a beast in combat. It puts his damage track up from quite small, I think like 1, 2, 4 or something. It puts it up to 3, 4, 5 or 3, 4, 6 or something. Yeah. And he can also, the flicker becomes quite beneficial. He can discard flicker to reduce damage that he takes. So he can become a little bit of like a melee monster when Asami dies, which is quite fun. To be honest, it doesn't happen very often. He's usually dead by the time Asami dies, but I quite like it. Fluff wise and story wise,
exactly.
But also, you know, he can pack a punch if he needs to. He's often, if he's not following around some other people of the crew, removing their flicker, sometimes he's a bit of a bodyguard for Asami. You know, he's an Oni to pass on the attacks to with protected,
right?
And with manipulative, you know, he's not that impactful, so you don't really need to activate him early in a turn. You know, turns 2 or 3 or 4, you know. But so with manipulative, passing on attacks to him can actually really, you know, really can scupper your opponent's plans, really, if you pass on attack to him and then it's manipulative and they miss. So, and he's insignificant, which I actually really like in totems because it means he's not a liability mm-hmm. in some of, you know, with some of the strats and schemes. So, yeah, I like him. I'm Andrew.
Yeah, no question. Greg, how about you? What are your thoughts on the totem?
I've pretty much the only thing I wanted to add to what Alex said there was that it's worth noting that he still gets to, he removes all his flicker when he attaches the upgrade. He can actually, because of say his damage then jumps up, he does actually become, especially, you know, his Asami tends to die towards the end of the game. And he can mm-hmm. actually kind of trade for your opponent's pieces really well. By chucking a couple of focus attacks in, you know, with minimum damage, you know, it's something like, I think he tops out at 6, it's like 3, 4, 6 or something like that he goes up to.
And he's got crit strike.
But with, oh,
wow.
You know, and he's got crit strike. And he has the ability, another one of his triggers, he can gain a flicker token to take the same action again. So he can potentially, you know, put out 4 focused attacks on 3, 4, 6. And then he will immediately die after that. But that's right. A hell of a lot of pain coming out of just a little totem, which, again, it doesn't really happen that often. He tends to die first before Asami, but it can really take someone, you know, he can come out of nowhere with the Asami soul upgrade, especially, again, if they're split up. Suddenly, you know, once Asami dies, one side of the board comes safe, another side of the board can become actually really dangerous.
Nice.
Because you've got this little blue guy running around stabbing things.
Oh, that's cool. So, Greg, after the totem, what is one of your first hires in an Oni crew?
So one of the things I never actually leave home without is Akaname, these beautiful little trash goblins. And one of the reasons for that is their ability to basically drop a scheme scrap or course marker in base contact with the model as a bonus action. Now we do gain a flicker to do it, and because it's a cost gaining a flicker, so even if you black joke at that bonus action, you've paid your cost. A lot of Asami's only models, a lot of their flashier abilities will require you gain flicker. Again, going with that candle burns twice as bright thing. But they've also just got a great little melee attack. It's only disgusting. Stat 4, but it's got a 2-inch range. And it gives out slow automatically, which is just absolutely big. Superb. Really big. And then they've got these a couple of beautiful synergies around kind of corpse markers and poison. So they can actually pick up corpse markers themselves. And it gives them poison 3. Now, they don't take any damage from that. They actually heal the damage.
Mm-hmm.
And they can also, when they would gain flicker, you can actually just reduce your poison condition by 2. So if they're, you know, they're not, you know, exactly frontline combat models. They've only got, you know, 4 wounds. And the defense is only 4, pretty poor. But if they can, you know, eat up your corpse markers from your opponent's models, it's worth noting that only themselves don't drop corpse markers or anything like that. Actually, once they get a stack of poison on them, they almost become immune to the flicker.
Right.
Because when you gain flicker, you just distribute poison off themselves. You know, if they take a random pot shot or like a random blast mark or shockwave or something, again, that poison will just heal it back. And so they become strangely durable to kind of chip damage. And again, the ability to just drop a marker, you know, when engaged, also on return you're summoned as well,
mm-hmm.
which can be really, really, really important. You know, dropping a ski marker on return you're summoned is massive. Dropping markers for a Sami to pick up to heal, again, also massive.
Yep.
So yeah, no, they are beautiful, beautiful little Josh Goblins.
Yeah, that's a lot of value for 4 points.
Oh, it's, yeah, you get a lot of them. Again, they do die with Stiff Breeze, but they're not going to affect your opponent's crew. Obviously, the slow is massive, but it's melee 4. Most of the time, most of the way I play them anyway, they are slower than average scheme runners, is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. They sort of usually start off with 1 in the crew, sometimes 2, and they are a common summon. But that 2-inch melee is really, really surprising. Yeah. So you summon them within 6 of a Sami, already engaging an enemy, and you know they either walk to get into engagement, and then they hit you, or then they have to disengage. So it's almost a slow in itself. Hmm. But if an Akinami has gone, you know, say it charges someone, their attack actually targets movement, which is a little bit strange, but I suppose can get around some defensive triggers and things. You know, and you can spend a flicker on it to get, you know, positive to that stat 4. You know, you probably just poke them for 1 damage and a poison, but slow, and it's crippling. You know, if you slow an enemy model and they're also in your engagement but not engaging you, it sometimes feels a bit like you've paralyzed them from M2E. Really impressive little. So you do that, and then they also, for their quick action, they vomit up a scheme marker or another marker that you need, and then they do an awful lot of work. Probably my favorite models in the crew, little trash goblins.
Very nice. So you mentioned, Alex, that you definitely hire 1, you might bring in 2. After the Akiname, where do you start looking as you are building your crew?
I'm an Ozako. She's my main lady. She comes in every single crew. So she's a 10-point henchman. And I think I take her in every crew just because she's really, really flexible. She can beat face with a 3-4-5 damage track. Obviously she can be spending flicker to make those focused attacks. She's movement 6 with flight. She's got terrifying. She's willpower. She's only defense 5, but she's got willpower 7. So, you know, she's hard to control by the enemy, but she's movement 6 with flight and then a really good damage track. The other thing that she brings that I use an awful lot is her quick action, Dark Bargain. So it's like an obey. The target, you need a 5 to cast it. The target suffers 1 damage, and, well, actually, armor gets a flicker on the trigger. So what it does is you tell the target to take an interact action, and that can be herself or that can be someone else. And that's really important, just getting those interacts down. It means you're not having to, you know, other models aren't using their AP. But because it's a tactical action, she can tell herself to do it. And there's a trigger on it with a mask where she gains a flicker, but instead of it being an interact action, she can take any action. So,
oh, wow. Nice.
In a way, I sort of see her as a 3 AP beater.
Yeah.
And with movement six and flight, she goes wherever I need her to, and kills things or schemes. Like, you know, like oftentimes we talked about movement and positioning in Malifaux, and sometimes people will do like a this sort of like refused flank sort of business, or they'll just run away, or stuff will die where she is. And often we're with a normal beta, maybe they're stuck there or they're trying to reposition. But with her being able to interact for a quick action, she can put two bombs down if it's explosives, or she can put two scheme markers down for harness the ley line. You know, so she can. It doesn't feel too bad her having to scheme run for as a 10-point model, because she's got 3 AP almost.
And she's dangerous. That min 3 savage bite is a nasty attack.
Yeah, it really is. She can be a bit, she can feel a bit squishy, actually. Like, I tend not to run her up the middle, because with defense 5, I know she's a henchwoman and she's got terrifying, but she does, well, anyone can go down to concentrated attack. So she tends to sort of like dance around on the flanks for me. She's quick enough to catch up and eat an opponent's scheme runner. And if she does take a bit of damage, she's got two triggers on her attack, one after killing and one after dealing damage, where she heals that amount. So she's really, really resilient from just your opponent putting like 2, 3, 4 damage on here and there. She just tends to heal it up when she attacks and as she kills people. But if they put loads of focus on her, she'll go down. So for me, she tends to be on the edges a little bit. But I love her. Amano Zako, she's wonderful. And often it's her that Amanjaku, the totem, is following around, removing the flicker, so that she can have that effective 3 AP every turn. And that's, we talked a little bit about soul stones, and Greg was saying he takes quite a high cash. I tend to take quite a high cash as well, usually between 5 and 8. And sometimes you want them so that you can be guaranteeing the trigger on her quick action, so that she can be having that third AP, or she can be giving that third AP to someone else, whether that be a Jorogumo to charge, or any of the other key models in the crew that if you need them to do something. So,
Greg, is there any other core Onis that you're hiring, or do you start flexing right away to versatile or out of keyword?
Before we get onto that, I just want to touch on something else with Amano Zako, if that's okay.
Please.
Going back to what Alex said with the high soulstone cash, that's exactly right. That's exactly why I have quite a high soulstone cash myself. It's Asami wants the stone for summons, Amano Zako wants the stone for her bonus action. And the other thing is that she does have a tactical action to lay down hazardous terrain.
Yeah,
I'm not sure about you, Alex, but I don't think I've ever used this.
I've never used it. That's why I didn't mention it.
Yeah, I know we in the kind of Ten Thunders Facebook Messenger group, we had a really kind of, actually really long, really good discussion about kind of this ability and hazardous terrain in general. So I thought I might just touch on kind of why we love this model, but we actually just don't use one of her kind of core actions. And part of that's a cost. You know, it needs a suited card to actually get the hazardous terrain off. Even though it's a 4-inch bubble and on a 50mm base, that's huge. But you also have to gain a flicker token for it. And so I'm a little bit like, when it comes to kind of, yes, you can potentially deny space with it, except you haven't really denied space. What you've said is that if your opponent wants to interact within that space, there's like an additional tax on top. And if you're playing against kind of a above average, a good opponent, they're going to know if that cost is worth paying.
Right.
And if it is, you know, if it scores you points, you only got an 8-point game, a good player is going to take that choice. So it doesn't really, you know, it helps you against weaker players, but that it doesn't help you against kind of, you know, the cream of the crop, which is kind of what I look for in a model.
Yeah.
And then going back to your original question there, Craig, I think that is pretty, oh no, Tengu. Beautiful, beautiful Tengu. So again, this is again one of my favorite Oni models, mainly because of that dark bargain ability that we spoke for with Amano Zako. Unfortunately, this guy doesn't have the trigger to obey any model, but then he's only 4 points. So if he did, he'd probably be way, way above the power curve. which still has movement 6. He still has flight. He can stop funny models getting distracted and slow, but it does cost you a card. And again, I don't think I've ever used it. He has the standard flicker stuff, but his attacks are nothing to write home about, really. This guy's main job is scheme running. So walk 6, move 6, sorry, with flight is absolutely superb. He also has Dark Bargain. So again, he can Dark Bargain himself, so he can move 12 inches and drop a scheme marker. He can also then cause someone else to interact instead, which again is going back to what we said at the very start of the podcast about that Asami really rewards planning ahead and really managing your side of the game, because you know you can summon a Tengu to fly 12 inches and then tell someone else to interact, but to do that, you need to have that other model in the correct place. So they're great little force multipliers. They have a little bit of healing as well, but again, it's a bit of a more of a corner case issue. They have a pulse that can heal all models, so it actually includes your opponents within 5 inches, one damage. Now you can potentially do that twice by gaining a flicker token, but for me, they you know they're little scheme bots. With again the potential to get 3 AP, even though one of those is an interact.
Right. So, obviously we're not done building the crew yet, but, you know, the two of the key models that you guys have brought up are two out of the three are four stone models. Is there any other big models outside of Ama that you're bringing in? Is that where you start flexing out to versatile, Greg?
Yeah, pretty much. So two of the models that I large models that I quite commonly take that are versatile are the Dawn Serpent and the Yasunori. Now, Dawn Serpent is one of my favorite models in the game, mainly because a lot of what he does isn't flashy. Now, he's movement 7 and flight, which by itself is superb. He's lightning fast. Now, he also has agile, so he's really hard to pin down.
Mm-hmm.
Also hard to kill, has his own built-in healing. He's very self-contained. You know, doesn't require anything from Asami, doesn't require any of her AP, which you're already trying to juggle by keeping all of his Oni around and managing all of his flicker system. Because Asami only has 3 AP, so she can only really remove a maximum of 3 flicker a turn. And so I like having a few big versatile models in there that she doesn't have to worry about, or Amon Jakku doesn't have to worry about.
Yeah.
And with Dawn Serpent, again, you know, he lives, he survives. He's also got 3, 4, 5 damage track. You know, no triggers on it at all, but it is a stat 6. So he's just really, really consistent without any kind of extra support from Asami, which, again, I suppose when it comes to kind of be a competitive play and not knowing exactly what models your opponent's going to put down or how the game's going to go, I really like that consistency. And I really like his ability with the agile and the movement 7 and the flight to just switch gears, that he can quite happily scheme and then dash into the middle, just to start ripping face with, melee 6, min damage 3. Or he can go the other way around. He can come up the center and then bounce out to the flank to drop a scheme marker somewhere late game. The other model's Yasunori. Again, very, very similar reasoning to a Dawn Serpent. Very consistent model, stats really, really good. Again, movement 7 with flight, superb. His unnatural reflexes trigger is absolutely brilliant. So but on the face of it, he wants masks, and the Sami also wants masks. But because he generates his suits from the number of cards in your opponent's hand, so in early game, early in the turn, when your opponent's got a full control hand of 6, he's essentially armor 3. Which combined with his hard to wound means he takes a lot of putting down.
It's so good.
It doesn't reduce to 0 is absolutely brilliant. So, we don't have to spend too many cards defending him at all.
Yeah.
His attacks, again, melee 6, positive flip built in, superb. Again, mask triggers, but he can get those built in. So he needs essentially nothing from Asami herself. And one of my favorite abilities he actually has is his bonus action, the Wind's Wrath. And all that does, it's a 3-inch pulse from his 50 mil base, and it moves himself and other models in range up to an inch. And it just randomly has loads of little, a lot of utility, especially about keeping him mobile. For example, if someone has, let's say, a 1-inch engagement range, if they're engaging him, then he pushes them 1 inch away and he pushes an inch away. So unless, you know, you've got a 2 inch engagement range and you're in base to base with him at the start of combat, providing that you know, the opponent's model and the Asinori has space to move, he actually mm-hmm. can't be tied down. And then with flight, he just leaps over the top and goes off and does his thing. And again, I just really, really like the consistency. I know what I'm getting. And I've got lots of different options. Again, if needs be, he can scheme because he's fast enough, because he has flight.
Yeah, I mean, what we're really seeing now as you guys go through this is we're seeing incredibly fast, incredibly versatile and flexible models, and a lot of flight too. So I'm really starting getting a feel of kind of the play style that the two of you guys are building up to. Alex, how about generic 10 Thunder upgrades? Is there any generic 10 Thunder upgrades that you're finding yourself using with this crew?
Yeah, a couple. I don't think I rely upon them as much as some people, but it depends on the situation, really. So, and obviously with the hire. So sometimes I'll hire a samurai, and sometimes I'll have trained ninja on the samurai, just so that it can, as we've been talking about, really, really sort of fast repositioning crews. Trained ninja just allows your samurai to from the shadows up there and sort of start acting straight away. And obviously depending on what master your opponent's declared, but master agent is always a consideration. The upgrade that turns off resistive triggers in a bubble. So, your opponent declares collect or zip, then you can stick a master agent on Yasunori, maybe even another one on Amanozako, and you can almost guarantee being, having those 2 6-inch bubbles to turn off resistance triggers. So, they're really important. Train ninja or mast agent, but they're usually just as and when the situation requires. And I think the more I play, the more masters I'm getting experience playing against, the more I'm finding when to use them and when not to. I'm not a sort of person that just sticks them on because I think, oh, actually, I'd like to deploy this guy a bit closer, or I think that maybe hard to kill is really good on that. I've got to have a purpose for it, because we've said we want a high cash with a Sami. 2 stones is part of that cash, isn't it? It's eating into that cash. So yeah, if I've got a purpose, then I'll use the upgrades.
Yeah. So Greg, can we talk a little bit about the summons? I mean, obviously, I don't want to cover every single model that she can summon, but I'd like to know what you consider some key summons.
The top two everyone goes for, or at least I tend to go for, are Jogomu and Katashiro. Obsidian only come in a kind of a close third. So Jogomu are your kind of big, flashy spider boy summon. Absolutely great stats. The damage is 3, 4, 6, 2 inch range with a stat 6. So you're already starting at a great place before you even think about having positive flips on that attack and damage because of Flicker. You've got Puncture, so you can potentially have even more positive flips on your damage.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've also have a couple of weird little bonus actions where they can actually stop healing in your opponent's crew, which can be randomly very clutch. If you're playing something like Mourning, to suddenly turn off that healing can actually be a massive deal. It's also range 10, which I remember for the first time I looked at it, it just struck me as being just really far for reasons I couldn't understand, but hey ho. he can also push other friendly models away from him. That's only a 4-inch push, and in a way itself it can be somewhat restrictive, but he's quite good at if you've got a model that's been engaged and you need to free it up. The Joe Goomer could charge that model. If you don't even kill the enemy model, you could always just scare your own friendly model away.
Right.
And so you've kind of still done the job. You've got a little bit of backup. They can also heal themselves when they kill an enemy model, as well as removing a flicker as part of a general keyword abilities. They can also just heal 2 damage, which is really, really good.
Yeah, I'm looking at that Mark of Vengeance, Greg, and the first thing I notice is it's obviously not an opposed duel, right? It is an opposed duel, but you don't have a target number.
Yes, willpower, yeah.
Yeah, so with no target number, and I noticed it's got a nice little shielded on a RAM. So I would make some of your mid RAMs pretty valuable, because depending on what model you're doing it against, you really question whether they're going to spend a high card to try to resist that.
Exactly. Yeah. Kind of the issue that I kind of have with the trigger is that it also directly competes with puncture.
Right.
And so with your stat six, sometimes you actually don't want to use flicker for the hit, because, you know, stat six is generally gets the job done. But being able to drop a mid to high RAM in to get an additional positive flip.
That makes sense.
Again, especially if it's a summon model, being able to kill a model without spending the flicker for the focus and remove one, you've kind of got a net benefit for, you know, 7-8 of RAMs is really, really good value.
So, Alex, what are some other key summons?
So Greg mentioned Obsidian Oni and Katashiro. Asami tends to be summoning, for me anyway, at the start of the game, the bigger summons, so Jorogumo, Obsidian Oni, and then later game when I'm sort of maybe trying to get those points, or I'm trying to bog down the opponent, those smaller summons, Akinami, Tengu, Katashiro, so they can do the scheming. So let's talk about Obsidian Oni. So these guys, you need an 11 to summon them, because they cost 7. They're sort of like the tanky. They've got armor. They've got Ruthless, which is you know, really, really helpful. The other thing they can do is they can remove destructible markers as a quick action. So nice. They are. So these guys are answering problems. You know, if your opponent's playing Raspi or Titania, you know, they can be removing those markers to sort of like free up the space and free up the positions. And then they can, you know, the melee six, the 2-3-4 damage, which, you know, isn't anything to write home about, but they've got crit strike and they can give burning on triggers. And they've also got, they do have a ranged attack, one of the sort of rare ranged attacks in the crew, that can give out burning and can drop scrap markers. So it's a way of getting scrap markers. I think I should talk about flicker bombing things, or I think people have referred to that term of summoning something and then going in. And Obsidian Oni are often the sort of target of this. You know, summoning Obsidian Oni,
the poster child, really.
Yeah, the poster child of this, because it's because they've got Demise Flaming 2. So when they're killed, models within 2 inches suffer 2 damage and burning 2. So you can make an Obsidian Oni. You can push it forwards, push it so you can push. You can walk forward with Asami 5 inches. You could summon an Obsidian Oni another 6 inches ahead of you, and they've got a 40 mil base. And then you push them another further 6 inches ahead, so they're now 19 inches up the board. Mm. If you've got a straight path, and then they can go in and they can do 2 focused attacks with the flicker, and then they die. And that can be really, really impactful. You know, two sort of stat six focused attacks, and then dying to do 2 damage to everyone around. I think it works against players that either aren't expecting it, or running crews that ball up, that really need to sort of be close together. But I think the more people play against Asami, they'll come to expect that and they'll start countering it. So I actually don't, like, I usually actually find myself not playing in that sort of way. I tend to act like I'm going to do that, summon Obsidian Oni, push them forward, go in with the Obsidian Oni, but not actually spend all my flicker, not actually do the focus attacks, just make 2 normal attacks. Because then actually, you know, from the opponent's point of view, you've got an Obsidian Oni sort of stuck in your crew. It's armor 1. You know, it's got 7 wounds. And if they do kill it, it's going to explode. Right. And if they don't kill it and they, you know, they disengage, they move around, it disrupts their plans, well then, next turn, you can always do you can always have 2 more focus attacks and then explode. And yeah, you might not catch as many people in the aura, but you've given them a turn where they've had to be trying to deal with this 40 mil based armor 1 model in their crew. And if they kill it, you don't really care that much, you know, but usually I'm trying to find, maybe I'm not killing my summons the turn that I summon them. I'm usually trying to get 2 turns out of them. I'm trying to eke out a little bit more value, but maybe that's because I'm greedy. I'm not sure.
Greg, do you find yourself using the flicker bomb, or
Not that often. These guys are kind of my like butterfly jump assassins. Because models with butterfly jump tend to have relatively low wounds. And so that's kind of when I tend to go for the bomb, you know, like, one and other monks just have a target on their heads. Because you can get so far forward, you can generally charge the model. I'll spend the flicker because I want to be in the upper damage bands. And then they're going to butterfly jump away. But if you've got an AP left, you can just walk, stand next to it, end your activation, another two damage, another two burning.
Yep.
And that generally puts them in the ground.
Yeah.
And the ranged attack's good for that sort of thing as well. You can go in, you can make an attack, someone jumps away, so you shoot them instead. You know, you're still getting your two attacks on them if you need to. So that's what I find against butterfly jump. People that have got melee,
exactly,
melee attacks and shooting attacks, you know, they're good around that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's two damage and two burning on top of it.
Exactly. And you know what's going to happen, right? Like if you shoot, you can miss.
Yeah.
So if you definitely need that guy dead, just stand next to them and demise.
Well, and I love that nasty choice, Greg, that you talked about, which is, okay, I'm not going to kill him. I'm going to leave him there and make him a pain in your behindicus. And if you want to kill him, that's great. I'm a huge fan of you killing him too, because here's four damage by the end of the turn.
Exactly. And they spent resources killing him as well.
Right.
I suppose that's what you'll find as well, Alex. Yeah. So these guys, because you're summoning on four wounds and you've got armor, you take a lot of putting down. And if you really want, you can spend flicker on the defense.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. They can go into you, and you can spend the flicker on the defense. They attack you, and then you explode if you need to. Yeah. So yeah, they take a lot of putting down, and I think that's what I like about the crew with Akinami, sort of slowing people, engaging them. You know, Obsidian only getting in your face, and then you know taking AP and resources. Jorogumo, you can't end within 2 inches and make an attack action if you've done a charge. So they're hard to get into as well. And with a 2-inch melee, they can sort of bog people down. So the entire crew is really good at holding up. It's got some models that are really good at holding up people and getting in the way and draining AP.
Well, and I think the theme that is just getting stronger and stronger, guys, you're making the case of, is just how flexible all of this is. And the flexibility just seems everywhere between the movement, the pushes, the range of summons, I think, is very interesting. The fact that I can, you know, bring in some big, nasty things. I've got a lot of really strong, low-cost models. Alex, you made the point that, you know, her attack actions are legit. So maybe you don't even summon during her activation. And then to have Yasunori and the Dawn Serpent really being their own little mini crew, doing whatever needs to be done, that's very, very flexible. And it just seems every aspect we're seeing that.
Yeah, because if you've taken Dawn Serpent, Yasunori, and Amanozako, you know, I know Dawn Serpent's 9, but you've got 29 stones on 3 models there, but they're all reasonably self-sufficient. And yep. Amanozako can obey Yasunori to take a walk on the first turn. And then you're 7 inches further up the board, you know, and you've got a 9-inch threat with 4 attacks, or you've got a 16-inch threat with 2 attacks after you've walked 7 right. inches up the board. So yeah, the threat range is there on the first turn if you need it.
Yeah, the speed is pretty insane in this crew that you guys are putting together.
Yeah.
Now, Alex, we were talking offline, and you kind of mentioned kind of an interesting build that you've been playing around with. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. So we've mentioned a lot of self-sufficient models before the break, a lot of those big sort of beaters, really fast. But another part of my crew that I take quite often, maybe 70-80% of the time, is a Minako Ray and a summoning package. So Minako Ray, she's Last Blossom, but she's versatile. So she's 8 stone henchman, and she's just a really, really good model. So she's got laugh off, she can't be moved. She's got charge through, so she gets a positive when she charges. And if she kills someone that has activated, she gets fast. So you know she's a reasonably BT model, but she's got, for an AP, she can summon a Katashiro with a ten of tomes. So she has to use a scrap marker or a shadow marker. That's where she fits in with Last Blossom. But she summons a Katashiro. So what I'll often take is I'll take Minako Rey and one Akan army, or maybe Minako Rey and two Akan army, and they'll sort of deploy maybe with a Sami in sort of deployment, and all those flexible, flying, fast, other versatile models are sort of somewhere else in deployment zone. But you can have your Akan army walking up, vomiting up a scrap marker, and then maybe interacting to put a scheme marker down, so that the Akan army will put two markers down as well as walking up the board, and then Minako Rey can turn one of those scrap into a Katashiro, and nice. The scheme marker can be for Asami to eat with a quick action just for healing, because she's gonna use some health either for her summoning or for removing flicker. So the Akan army will put down a couple of markers to support Asami, but also the one of those is a scrap so that Minako can summon a Katashiro. And it just eases off some of the pressure on Asami summoning a Katashiro. Right. Minako can summon one to, a Katashiro turn one, and Asami can summon, a Jorogumo or an Obsidian Oni. And, it's just a really good first turn. Minako doesn't tend to be summoning Katashiro all game long. She'll just maybe summon one. Maybe she'll summon a second one on turn two, but then she'll tend to go get stuck in. But I really like Minako Rey. She's brilliant. She's got a quick action that can draw a card if you've got less cards than your opponent.
Yeah, no, it's worth noting, I think, that unlike Asami summons, Minako's Katashiro don't come in with an upgrade.
Yeah.
So they don't have that kind of ticking time bomb of Flicker Edition.
Yeah.
That a lot of Asami's other summons actually do carry.
Yeah.
So again, going by what Alex said, it just relieves that little bit more pressure off Asami herself.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, as a rule, I tend to not be real crazy about like two model combos like this. Yeah. But what's interesting about what you're talking about, Alex, is the 4-stone barfing gremlin that you're bringing in to help her is a good model on his own, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, he's definitely enabling the summons when you need it, but it's not like that's the only thing he can do for you.
Yeah. Yeah, he's only doing it really turn one. He's putting a marker down for Asami to heal off anyway. So it's only for the first turn, really. He puts a scrap marker down, you get a Katashiro, and then he's off doing his own thing, engaging people, trying to scheme. Actually, more likely he's dying, but he's getting in the way and he's doing his own thing. It's not a combo that you stick to. I'm not a big fan of those sort of combos, but it's just gets you an extra Katashiro. They're really good. Just gets you an extra scheme runner that'll move into a better position or hide somewhere on turn one, and then on turn two it's going to go and try and score a point or something. So Minako's brilliant, and the other thing she does, actually, people really don't want to attack her because of her defensive and willpower trigger,
right.
which is karmic debt. I don't actually have it in front of me, but that's because I think Jamie Varney stole it at Nationals. So I think he didn't. He's like, I don't like that. I'm gonna take that back to London with me, or I don't know, but down south somewhere. It's all the same to me.
I hope it's not Jamie that stole it, and there's some guy just maniacally laughing listening to this podcast right now.
Yeah, you'll never get to declare that defensive trigger again. But when someone attacks her. Sorry. So yeah, when someone attacks Minako, it's built in on the defense. It's not built in on willpower, but she's a henchman, so she can stone for it. After resolving, so they don't have to succeed, you give the model that attacked Minako the karmic fate upgrade. And that just says whenever Minako would take damage, the model with the upgrade also takes the same amount of damage.
Oh, nice.
So if you kill the model with the upgrade, you get a Wanyudo, the big rolling, burning wheel guy.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you attack Minako Rey, and then she goes in and kills that model that attacked her and summons yet another model, another movement seven model that's unimpeded, just adding to the massive movement of the crew.
And that's a huge swing, right? You're taking out a model and bringing in a 7-stone model.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, she's great. She's turn one, she'll summon a Katashiro, that's an extra model, and then doesn't happen very often. To be honest, actually, good players just don't attack her. And that's my advice. Just leave her alone. Because if you attack her, you're probably gonna end up killing your model that attacked her and maybe giving me another model. So most people just, but if they're avoiding her, then, you know, she's able to, she's movement six, you know, she's able to do, you know, have a go at someone or maybe summon some more or even scheme, you know, so.
Yeah, I was about to say she can score you points.
Yeah, she can score points. So,
so Greg, one thing I think is interesting is you have mentioned offline that there's a model that you like, the Terracotta Warrior, which all I hear is that that's a terrible model. But can you talk to us about how you like the Terracotta?
Yeah, sure. I think I'll start by saying that it is a generally, in most cases, in fact, almost all cases, it is a generally pretty terrible model. But actually, apart from with Asami, I actually love playing a Terracotta Warrior with Asami. He takes for me, in a lot of Asami crews you see out there, there's kind of this one slot. One slot, because I have a general aversion to support models. Which, mm-hmm. of course, is probably very well documented. So commonly people will take something like a Tanuki or a Low River Monk. So Low River Monk is just pure healing to try and manage that that wound count for a Sami. Wounds are a resource. The Tanuki can do a similar thing. Again, heal her and give her a focus to potentially make those summons a little bit easier. But what some people take both, which, I mean, I would honestly say is a mistake, but that's... due to my playstyle, how I play. The Terracotta Warrior, though, he's kind of what I put in that slot. Now, he doesn't actually heal a Sami. But what he does have, though, are two tactical actions, which I think fit very, very well with a Sami's crew. First one is just like you. Now, you can only do this once per activation, and he has to be within 5 inches of a Sami to use it in the way I'm about to say. And so what he does is he just basically copies the tactical action, non-bonus tactical action, of a model of a higher cost than the Terracotta himself, and he gets to use that action. And now, albeit with a cast of level of -2. And what I actually use this for is to copy a Mother's Love. So that's the ability that the Sami uses to remove Flicker and give focus, right? Because, you know, we've talked about how aggressive a Sami kind needs to be, how short range that is, and it does make it quite bubbly. But whereas with that Terracotta, I basically extended that bubble by a radius of 5 inches. And yes, I'm casting it on a 6 instead of a 4, but a 6 isn't still, you know, is nothing really to sniff at. I don't really find it to be the end of the world. He can also, he is significant, so he can actually, if he stands a little bit closer to a Sami, you know, he can chuck a ski marker out. Which then a Sami can then, as long as that's within 2 inches of a Sami, she can then pull it up to get her wounds back. And so I found that actually by being able to remove a Flicker, you know, outside of a Mother's Love range, I'm not using her ability where, you know, to take damage to prevent Flicker at the end of an activation. So actually it kind of balances itself out. Instead of healing her, I'm causing her to use her wounds less. Which then kind of stops her dying to kind of random spikes of damage and things like that. The other thing he can do, again, tactical actions, is he does have attack action. He does have attack action, but it's nothing to write home about. I'm not really going to touch on it at all. But Mode of the Other is his tactical action, his second one. And this is where he can replace himself with a minion or enforcer that was killed during that game. And now you've got a Sami here who's basically summoning minions all the time. So that's another potential way to get, you know, a Katashiro, a Jogomu, for basically the same card that a Sami would use for summoning. Bear in mind, he cons stone, so it needs to be the Suid Mask. But again, it comes in without having two Flicker added to it and without a Flicker upgrade. It does have kind of pseudo slow because of the way replace works. He's used an AP, so it's only going to come in with one AP, and it only comes in with 3 damage, so... but some of these, you know, low-cost models we were talking about, Tengu, Kaname, you know, coming in with only 3 wounds, sorry. It's not the end of the world. That just means you've taken one wound at some point. Jogomu can heal themselves. But the other thing that's worth noting is the Enforcer bit, because you can actually replace yourself into a Dawn Serpent if a Dawn Serpent's died. Dawn Serpent costs 9. So you need a 13 of masks, but, you know, suddenly you're getting the Dawn Serpent back, you know, who's move 7 and has a self-built-in heal, is absolutely superb. If you've got the Red Joker, you can actually bring Yasunori back. which is, again, can be a colossal swing. After they've ground through the Yasunori, suddenly he pops back up. Again, only three wounds, but it's a hell of a lot of offensive output potentially, because he, you know, can have built-in onslaught, so he can replace himself, charge, you know, bonus action for an inch, charge 7 inches, 2-inch melee range with two attacks because of a trigger. So yeah, it's really in Asami. I think he's got a really, really good spot, as does the Terracotta Warrior.
Yeah, I bet.
In a similar vein, the Kamitachi is one of those models which I don't take often. He's very much dependent on the opposing master and what I think I'm going to see in the opposing crew. So if and that's purely for his Wonder Weasel ability. So this is a once per activation ability, which after a model is summoned, I get a draw a card, which, you know, card draw for a summoner is absolutely superb.
Yep.
Now, the drawback of this is if it was a friendly model that was summoned, I've got to discard a card. So this is more card cycling than it is card draw in just a pure Asami crew. Now, however, if I'm playing against another summoner,
mm-hmm.
Or I think, you know, it's a model that, or there's going to be a model in the crew which is going to summon other models. Let's say it's Zoraida or something, for example, who, you know, might be summoning a voodoo doll. When the opposing crew summons, I draw a card, and that was not a friendly model. So actually, I get to keep that card. So for your opponent summoning models, they actually let you draw cards. And his bonus action, he has a bonus action, which I've actually, the more I've kind of used it, the more I've enjoyed it. And it's the Dust Devil ability, which lets him basically drop a 40mm hazardous terrain marker. And now for this one, he actually has to discard a flicker token to cast it. Mm-hmm. Instead of gaining one, and because it's a cost, unfortunately you can't just gain a flicker on the jewel and then discard it later. You need to have a flicker there to start with, which can be a bit tricky, but what I tend to do is either punch the Terracotta Warrior with a Kamitachi and use a flicker on the hip, but right. Actually flip the defense of the model and basically make myself miss, or at least get me on to try and get me to a double negative flip or something, just to keep the damage on the attack down. And once he's got the one flicker, you can just kind of run around with your Dust Devil. And his attacks then can then move the Dust Devil marker about. So instead of moving, you know, an enemy model into hazardous terrain and causing damage, you actually move the hazardous terrain marker 6 inches, which yep. Actually on a 40mm base, you can tend to clip, you know, a couple of models, you know, generally minimum two, sometimes three or four, depending on how the game's gone. And actually, that little chip damage, which normally I don't really have much time for, but actually, because it's only on a 4-stone insignificant model, it actually really adds up. And combining that with a card draw, I find when I'm playing against another summoner, he still gives me value.
Well, I was about to say, Greg, I mean, what a great tech piece for 4 stones when you know they've already declared a summoner master on their side, because you know you're going to get value as a card cycle, and then, you know, you're going to be drawing. And what's crazy about that Wonder Weasel ability, I mean, granted, it's once per activation, but there's no range on it. So that summon could be happening, you know, 25 inches away from the Kamitachi, and you're still drawing the card.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I mean... Sometimes, well, before I kind of realized how good the Dust Devil ability was, it was quite common that he would just stand behind a wood or a house mm-hmm. somewhere and just almost be like a pass token and got me cards. But yeah, because yeah, as you say, it's got no range. It's absolutely superb.
So guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to find out, you know, and I have a feeling I might know the answer, but I want to find out if there's specific strategies and schemes that they feel that the Oni crew performs well in. So we'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. With 3rd edition Malifaux released, it's time for you to get a new mat with new deployment zones. We've tried every mat in the business, and nobody has better quality and selection than Mats by Mars. They're waterproof and they roll and unroll easily, and they're even wet erase Marco compatible. They offer over 35 designs and let you add M3EO overlays for making deployment and positioning a breeze. Check them out at matsbymars.com. They are offering a sweet discount for our listeners. After you found the perfect mat, use the promo code 3rdfloor to get 10% off your entire order. If you really want to support us, in the notes of your order, request that our logo be put in the corner of your mat. It's the only way to make the best mat in the business even cooler. Again, that's Mat by Mars. Use the promo code 3rdfloor to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. Well, how interesting is it to have two guys that, you know, have been playing this Oni crew for a while, and they're good buds too, but they really have already kind of found out their own little mini builds that they've been experimenting with and having success with. It's part of what I love about Malifaux is that there, I don't care what anybody says, there's no right way to play it. There's no right crew to build. It really comes down to how you want to get things done. And we're so early into this edition, I think we're going to start seeing some really interesting combinations, not just for, you know, a master like Asami, but for a lot of the keywords that are out there. So Alex, when, you know, you're a 10 Thunders player and you're on your seventh round at Nationals, what strategies, is there one or two strategies that come up that make you really consider bringing Asami in?
So it'll be plant explosives or corrupted idols. They're the two that I bring Asami in. We've spoken about like this flexibility, this power, this speed that she has, and I think the reason I picked those strategies for her is because she's able to not have the disadvantages of playing the other strategies, if that makes sense. So we've talked about Flicker and her crew dying when they get to models dying when they get to three Flicker in anyone's activation. Not only that, but a lot of her crew is actually quite vulnerable. They're quite squishy, so it makes Reckoning such an uphill struggle when you're playing Asami, and also Turf War. When I'm distracting people with models and bogging people down with models and losing them probably quite quickly, flipping those turf markers back to neutral can be quite really detrimental. So plant explosives and corrupted idols are the two strats that allow me to play to her strengths without having those disadvantages.
Well, and lucky for you as a 10 Thunders player is you've got strong other keywords for Turf War and Reckoning, right? So it's not like you don't have other options. So that's good. Greg, let's think about schemes a little bit. Are there any schemes in particular that if they're in the pool and you've got Asami, you're definitely going to be picking those schemes just because she's built to score them?
Yeah, a lot of it's actually kind of centered around the marker heavy schemes, as you probably can imagine about how much we've talked about the ability to drop scheme markers all over the place. Breakthrough, we described playing very, very fast crews. You know, getting across the ball is not a massive problem. Dig Their Graves, I actually really like with her, mainly because it's the second point that she really, really shines in, because you can create course markers with Akaname. So if you need course markers, you can just summon Akaname and it can just make them for you. At the same time, Akaname and Asami herself can also remove course markers, and Asami can remove scrap markers. So you can actually deny your opponent, and only models don't drop course markers themselves.
Yep.
So it can be quite a hard scheme for your opponent to score, but actually quite an easy one for you. Because even if you're playing against Hoffman and he's dropping, I suppose it doesn't really matter anymore, does it? I'm stuck in addition behind. But if you need course markers in a small corner of the board where Sammy's hiding, you just make some.
Yep.
And then you drop some scheme markers next to them.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's absolutely superb. Outflank is a great one.
Yeah, and so much of what we talked about, Greg, is you know, we've talked about how fast this crew is, these incidental markers and the ability to get markers down where they want them to be, and the ability for you to get your models where they need to be and actually disrupt the positioning of other models. I mean, I look down the list of schemes and, you know, so many of them require some of that. And you've got that flexibility to go in there. What I'd be curious to know, though, Alex, is if my opponent declares Asami, are there schemes in the pool that I should make sure I don't take because she can really shut them down hard?
Yeah, yeah. So when you're facing Asami, she's the one that's going to be herself personally is the one that's going to be stopping your schemes. So we've mentioned that her quick action removes scheme scrap and corpse markers around her. So if you're trying to do search the ruins, you know, and you're trying to get into my half, and you're trying to put down scheme markers next to terrain, she can just walk up and eat them. Same with breakthrough, same with harness the ley line, because she wants to be a little bit forward anyway. You know, we said that sort of aggressive support, summoner master. She's probably going to be a little bit up towards the center line anyway. So she's going to be slightly hanging back just behind the front line, but still up there. And she's just going to respond and eat your schemes when you put them down. That's one way that she's going to, deny your schemes. The other way is with her tendrils, with her hair. So she's, right. You know, if I get an inkling that maybe you've taken claim jump, and I can't get someone up there, I could always push a friendly model up to contest it, or I could push the enemy model away. I think I'd push the friendly model up because it's less demand on the flips. But if I really needed to, I could push an enemy model away. For outflank, I can use the hair to push an enemy model out and deny that outflank point. And once someone goes for outflank, it tends to be a little bit obvious. So pushing them away, denying that point for that turn, and it gives you the next turn to kill one flank of your opponents to deny. Mm-hmm. So she'll deny outflank. She'll deny, claim jump, maybe take prisoner just because of some of the summons. She's the one. She can deny an awful lot. She can deny an awful lot. She can, let's say, eat all the markers, eat all the corpse markers for dig, and push people around. So she's the one that's going to be stopping you. So maybe that leads into our next point about how to beat her. Actually,
we're going to be headed in that direction. Yeah, so yes. Let's take a quick break, guys. And when we get back from this break, I want to talk about two things. One, I'm really anxious now to find out how to counter this Oni crew because it sounds really scary. But I also want to find out really where the second level play is for this. So, you know, as a person gets to their fifth game, their 10th game, their 20th game running Asami, what are some things that they're going to discover? These guys have had those that type of experience. So let's find out what they discovered. We'll be right back. So how much are three or four of these episodes worth to you a month? Third Floor Wars has a Patreon, and if you think they're worth $1, $5, $20 a month, swing by and become a patron. We have polls to decide the next episode of the pod, along with early releases of articles and podcasts. Everything we release goes out to everyone, but sometimes our patrons get a head start. The link is in the show notes, or just search for Third Floor Wars on Patreon.com. Thanks for the support. So I want to give a quick shout out to our top patrons as of the time of this recording. A big thanks to Nick Westbrook, Colin, Stephen Morris, Kevin Smith, Sam Newman, and Jeremy Peace. We appreciate everybody's support. So, you know, if you listen to this podcast, you know that second level play is something that we talk about with all of these deep dives. And, you know, I think we've talked already about how much you have to keep balanced with this master. So, Greg, I mean, what do you consider second level play with Asami? What are things that somebody who has gotten in the reps and gotten in a ton of games with Asami, what are they going to get good at in order to be successful?
Yeah. So we said this a lot, on this podcast already, but I can't stress it enough is planning ahead. Because, you know, a lot of the scheming stuff we've talked about, models can't interact on a turn of summon. So if you're summoning a scheme runner, you've got to do them, you know, summon those guys. If you want to drop scheme marker in turn five, you've got to summon that in turn four. Mm-hmm. You know, look at Tengu, right? We've said how much we love Tengu, and being able to fly 12 inches and then Tarry Soft drop ski marker is superb. What's even better is being summoned, flying 12 inches to intercept the Dawn Serpent, which you've moved to another spot. So I think a lot of the things you'll find, you know, when I play Sammy, and I imagine this is true for yourself, Alex, is that halfway through a turn, you know, your opponent might be like, well, why is that guy over there? Why has he moved this here? And then suddenly, you know, at the end of the turn, all the kind of pieces have come together. A bit like putting a jigsaw together, but by putting the pieces down in what might seem to your opponent a random order, but you're
right
constructing a board state yourself through her movement, her summons, the different levels of out of activation, movement and AP. So that's absolutely massive. There's also a huge part which ties into kind of what I've been saying is value. But a lot of that is also to do with risk. And so we talk about Amanozako's, adding a flicker to put Hazard's Terrain up as not being good value. And that's because, you know, we've kind of considered this, and we're comparing a flicker for Hazard's Terrain compared with a flicker on the attack, or gaining a flicker for her Dark Bargain trigger to generate a third AP for a model. And so, like, well, actually, I've still spent a flicker. I've still gained a flicker. But what have I done with that? Okay, well, on one hand, yep. I've generated Hazard's Terrain. That hasn't done anything. On the other hand, I've told Yasunori to take another attack, and that's killed, you know, one of my opponent's key models. Well, actually, that flicker meant far more to taking that key opponent's piece, or, you know, dropping a bomb for plant explosives or ski marker or something, than it would just putting Hazard's Terrain up, which my opponent may or may not decide to enter. And the risk thing, again, comes down to that flicker management. That, yes, flicker management is important, but I'm kind of trying to touch it on as a wider concept, in that, you know, do I, if I'm going to spend, you know, go up to three flicker for this attack, how sure am I that I'm actually going to do the hit? Because I might want a positive damage to kill the model, but actually, if I don't hit them, that means nothing. And yep. So then I've got to consider, you know, how many cards does my opponent have? How many cards do I have? And all of this other bits and pieces just takes on this extra level when you kind of combine it with managing Asami's flicker and Asami's wounds. And you kind of need to get those reps in that you were talking about, Craig, to figure out actually how this machine works. You know, Alex and I are talking about it quite freely because we've been playing, you know, a lot of Asami in the past 4 or 5 months. Whereas when I first started, I think my first Asami game was about 3 hours long because I was trying to figure out, well, should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? Oh, wait a second. I can't put this guy the other side of the wood because then he's not going to be in Asami's aura to do damage to her to not take his third flicker point, and I want him to stay around. And so, you know, but it takes a while to kind of get all of those different aspects and all those different considerations you've got to make to kind of keep this train moving. And then again, I think that might come back to why we have so many big self-sufficient first-time models in the crew.
Right.
It's because at least that, you know, if we swapped out Dawn Serpent and Yasunori for two Jogomu, it's rough, you know, roughly the same cost in Soul Stones, but then we've got two other Flicker models we've both got to think about, and that's something else to manage. I think the final point might be just to touch on something Alex mentioned about Amanjaku following Amanozaku around. Now, I think a lot of people, myself included, when you first start, was actually you tend to just keep Amanjaku next to Asami because, you know, totems stick next to masters and he's an Oni and she can pass off attacks to him, etc. And the concealment aura is really good. And so, you know, you want to use that to protect your master. But actually, there's only really two models in the crew, unless you know, I'm taking a Terracotta Warrior, that actually do the flicker removal. And so having those two models in the same place actually really restricts what your other models can do. And so you kind of, it seems a little bit counterintuitive at times, but actually split those guys up. And then, you know, you've kind of got one kind of good bubble, one bad bubble, if you know what I mean. One guy's just taking flicker off, but at least he's, you know, 10, 12 inches away from Asami maybe. And then she's summoning and she's influencing her own part of the board.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Greg, the that jigsaw analogy where you're putting down the random pieces, but until that last piece goes down, you don't get to see the picture, I think is a really good one. I mean, that's a huge challenge for that Asami player to really, you know, thinking in, you know, a turn or two ahead, let alone it's hard enough thinking activations ahead, let alone turns ahead. But what I would imagine is also great about that is exactly what you kind of did the narration on, which is it makes it hard for your opponent to figure out what the hell you're trying to do. And then it sounds like they figure it out too late.
Hopefully. unfortunately, luck is still a factor. And then sometimes cars can just go south.
My sort of second level play is something Greg said and something we've been saying a lot, but it's her crew is all about that resource management, more so than a lot of other crews I've played, because you've got the same resources that everyone's playing with, you know, AP, cards and stones. You've also got Flicker and Asami's health. So you're running on more resource, you're balancing more resources than you would normally be doing maybe in a crew. But then there's that other thing, which is that if you're spending Flicker to get positives to attack and damages, you're more likely to go on straight flips for damage. So there's more opportunity for cheating cards in for damage. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good thing. Obviously, you know, you've got more control over it. But with more options come more potentials for making mistakes. So you can be like, oh, well, I'm on that straight. Shall I put that 11 in to get the 6 damage? And it's sort of teases you to tempt you to put that severe in, you know, when you're on the straight flip, when actually maybe you don't need to. So that was something that I was doing when I first started playing Asami, was maybe being a little bit, I was finding that I wasn't using my cards as effectively as I'd like to, or as I needed to, because there were more opportunity to use them.
Yeah, when you're on a straight flip and you've got that severe in your hand, Alex, it's so hard not to use it, especially if exactly.
So it's that balancing of cards, because they're more easy to use, as well as also need them for summoning. But then, yeah, health, markers, positioning, flicker. and I suppose one thing you're trying to do actually is you can't apply that force everywhere on the table. You know, like, right. It sounds really good. You're like, oh, they can all have focus and they can all have this and they can all be doing that. They can't. They can't all be doing that, because then they're dead. You know, you've got to apply the force where you need it, which is a consideration. Maybe it's a second level play. It's a positive, mm-hmm. because you can apply the force where you need it. I need it on that flank. I'll be spending stuff there. I'll push people over there, or I need it next turn. I need it in this other place. You can be applying that force where you need it. But there's more scope for making mistakes there, because you can't apply it everywhere.
Right.
So that's my second level play tip, I think, is that resource management. And
One thing that I'd like to add to that as well is coming down to those resource managements, and part of the flexibility that we've discussed, and we've said how amazing it is and how many options you have, but it's actually to understand what those options are. Mm-hmm. And more than almost any other 10 Thunders Masters, that she will use her entire keyword of models at one time or another. Now, it might not be every game, but you will use them, and you need to know, and it's been said many times on this podcast, Craig, read your cards, understand what everything can do. And that's doubly so with Asami, because you need, especially your summons, right? Your summons aren't going to be around long. You need to understand. And what Alex said about applying force, it's not just force. It's also, dropping scheme markers, how you interact with the board. You've got a great toolbox, but you need to understand what tool to take out of it. Right. And for me, Yokai are a great example of this, that Alex, and I, we both dislike Yokai. We both lamented, many times about how far they've fallen. But one key thing about Yokai, is that they can interact while engaged. Now, again, you have to plan ahead, but sometimes that can be really, really useful. Yep. So I may never, I might not summon a Yokai in 10, 15 games, but when I need to do that, I know that I can go to Yokai. I know what card I need to summon them. I know, what I need to do, and you can kind of pick that tool out of a drawer. Now, maybe that there's another way I could do it, but that's going to be, it's like trying to hit a nail in with a wrench. Like, it'll do the job, but a hammer would be better, mm-hmm. and you could use that wrench for something else.
Yeah, no question.
It's so just great. That does take reps.
It does, definitely, Greg. And I think those are all really good call outs. And it brings us back to something that I mentioned, which is this may not be the best first master for somebody new to the game, because there's a lot going on there. But boy, it sounds like there's a lot of value once you kind of get put in the work and learn her, because it can present to you, some really nice opportunities to do what needs to be done when it needs to get done. Greg, one of the things that I'd like to find out from you, though, is what does she hate to see? So when you've got Asami as your leader, you're going into a matchup. What do you hate the opponent to either see or do? What are some counters to this crew?
Guns are bad. Yeah. She really doesn't like getting shot. We talked about that resource management. You could plan your turn ahead perfectly. If Asami takes, let's say two to four wounds that you weren't expecting or that you hadn't factored into what you were going to do, well, that, she's only got 12 of them. If you're going to take another couple of wounds to reduce flicker on something, she's suddenly at half health. And so that's and basically a lot of things, just because she has to play so far forward, even melee pressure can be a situation she finds herself in quite commonly, which is where the reaching 10 drills comes in. Can sometimes be, instead of trying to disengage, just try and whip the enemy model away and then walk off yourself.
Yeah.
And that kind of comes back to one of the reasons that the crews that Alex and I tend to be so fast and have so many aggressive threats in is to kind of saturate, give your opponent that threat saturation and say, yes, you should be putting pressure on my master. However, you've also got these other things you should be worrying about. And if you do put pressure on Asami, well, that's okay. I can apply pressure in other ways, or, I can apply pressure in another part of the board. So you can't zero right in on my master.
Yeah, I would also imagine, Greg, that anything that's putting hand pressure on you is pretty rough, right? Like tons of shockwaves or things that are forcing you to discard. The cards in your hand are a big resource that you're trying to manage anyway.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's worth mentioning. We've talked about, using Dark Bargain to drop scheme markers, using your Kaname, like it's something that automatically happens, right? You're still flipping cards. Anytime you're flipping cards, you're taking away certainty from your game plan. You're taking away consistency from the crew. As you said, if you're making me churn through my deck, if you're making me discard cards from my hand, my game plan's getting just a little bit weaker, weaker. I mean, not just for Sam, it's a generally good Malifaux rule, right? Card advantage is a big deal.
Well, the funny thing about it all, too, and I chuckle about this a lot of times when I see discussions, on the forums or in AWP or, when we do these deep dives, even is Theory Foe is amazing, because when you're just putting stuff through your head and you're looking at cards, you forget that the opponent's playing the game, too. And you forget that, you're going to draw bad hands, or you're going to draw a bunch of great hands. You needed some cards to discard, and you don't want to discard those. So you're like, there's so many things that you don't know until you're playing and you've got somebody else trying to beat you. And it's why I preach it all the time, guys, is, you don't know until you faced it. You don't know until you've played it. Don't get me wrong, I love Theory Foe. I really do. I love talking about Foe. I like looking at cards and thinking about this, thinking about that. But if you're not putting in the table time, you're going to have to qualify your opinion about things.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially, Malifaux, you're talking plus 2 hours to get around in, so actually kind of getting a table time, getting those cycles to build up a decent sample size for any kind of theory you have is actually really hard. You could try something once and be like, yep, this works, this is superb, but actually that could have just been a freak occurrence, right?
Yep.
I kind of, at this point, I want to shout out the kind of 10 Thunders Facebook chat group, because one of the things I really, really like about that chat group is partially what you're saying, Craig, is that you have almost, you know, an infinite amount of fake opponents in there. But you said, hey, guys, I think this is good. And loads of people will critique it. And the critiques that come back are actually generally really constructive. It's you know, this is why, this is, you know, why I think it's a good idea. This is why I think it's a bad idea. But partially, we've recently, I mean, it might have been because we were discussing Asami recently, actually, Alex, but
we did a really good comparison.
The two of us, I think Ray was in there, a couple of the other guys. We did, yeah, we had some really, really good conversations about just more general topics. You know, that some of the things I talked about tonight, where instead of looking about flipping cars, we've talked about, you know, managing resources, we talked about considering risk, we talked about value, and we've had some really good discussions about what those concepts mean, which again, with someone like Asami, can actually really help even out that learning curve to just speak to some other people, get like a bit of a hive mind together to you know, what do I do in situation X? Well, you know, you thinking of something and testing it out is nowhere near as good as discussing that with, you know, five other people.
Exactly. No, could not agree more. Alex, is there anything that we need to add on to that? Some things that if I'm playing against Asami, I should consider bringing to the table?
So Greg said guns, which is an important point. But to go on from that, you know, the entire crew pretty much universally is a melee crew. So it's really predictable when you're the opponent of an Asami crew. I know it's really flexible, but it's really predictable about how it's going to try and kill your models, which is mainly in melee. So sort of disguised or, I don't know, the sort of extended reach stuff. Those things are quite important, you know, quite good for slowing us down.
Armor can be a big deal.
Armor, well, that's why I often take a samurai, just because armor.
Yeah, sorry, Alex, I'm just going to jump in and say armor.
armor sort of really limits you. But things, ironically, things that are a little bit similar to the Asami crew are really good against the Asami crew. So the key models, really, that you want to kill, and maybe I'm giving too much away, but I don't mind. The key models that you do want to kill when you're playing against Asami are the Katashiro, the Akinami, and the Tengu, because they're the ones that are going to, they're going to be going out, they're going to be scoring the points, especially the Akinami. Those guys are little bastards. You've got to kill them as quick as possible. But all of them, they're all defense four. Defense four with four or five wounds. So they go down, well, the Katashiro are literally made of paper, so they go down so quickly, but you have to target them when you're playing against Sam. You've got to kill those really quick scheme runners. And the rest of the crew can be quite fragile at times. We thought about maybe putting some pressure on Asami itself because she's taking some wounds herself, so it can shock her. She can heal up, but it's about when you apply that pressure to her. If you just put a little bit on her, she's probably not going to care because she'll be healing it up. But if you can put a significant amount on her because your opponent overextends and kill her, then that's huge, you know. So kill those defense four scheme runners and plan when you're going to put pressure on Asami. That's my advice.
Yeah. Just the timing of putting that pressure on her is big deal. And again, we're giving away kind of all our secrets here. But hey, that's the name of the game.
It means we'll get better games.
You know, you feel like you're giving away the candy store, right, Alex? You know, giving away these tips and talking about these counters. But that's part of the beauty of Malifaux is that, sometimes even if the opponent knows what to do, that means they still got to do it. It's not like other games.
I like it because then they'll try and do it. And then I get to sort of counter that, you know, because then I know that they know what the weaknesses are. And then when they come for it, I'll be able to respond. So
I know that you know that I know that you know. Greg, did you have some last thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to just add to what you said there, Craig, that, at the end of the day, you've got to assume your opponent's fully prepared anyway. And so if they are, then you should be able to handle it. If they're not, okay, the game's got a little bit easier for you, superb. And that goes back to what I was going to revisit, the timing of hitting Asami, is that her healing comes from her activation and maybe activation of another model. So if you wait until after those activations, you know, you can put some wounds on her, they're going to stick until next turn. And then you can go in maybe at the start of the next turn before she's had a chance to get some more wounds back. And you know, you create a little window for yourself to really, really go after her.
Yeah. Well, that's that timing of pressure, right, that you talked about.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose we kind of got all that a little bit the wrong way around, but hey, people figure it out.
Exactly. Now, guys, we're going to take one more break. And when we get back from this break, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I've got two strong 10 Thunders players on the pod today. Because when we talk about hot topics, there's been some hot topics around 10 Thunders. So I'm not going to let this opportunity come by or go by me. So we'll take a quick break and let's talk about what other people have been talking about. We'll be right back. Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. So I'm hoping to release this episode not too far since we're recording it, because on my Patreon, I give the patrons an ability to kind of influence the next episodes to come out. And guys, this, I told them that this was getting recorded and it got voted as they want this as the next episode. So I have a feeling, you know, sometimes it'd be several weeks before between recording and putting it out. I don't think that's going to be the case with this one, but that being said, I think even if this comes out 5 weeks from now, this will still be relevant. So, you know, 10 Thunders did well at the UK Nationals. And the I think the was a first and third or first and second or some of the podium, you know, soloed Shenlong, and the chanting started, the pitchforks came out, and you had people saying, is it too much? And then you had people coming in that have never played Shenlong or playing against Shenlong saying, yeah, he's too strong, this and that. You gentlemen have either played Shenlong or have played against Shenlong. So your voices, I think, are significant here. So Alex, how many times did you play Shenlong to get fourth at UK Nationals?
I didn't play Shenlong at all. I don't even own him. I played Asami four times. I played McCabe twice and I played Yan Lo once. And I came fourth. So, so Shenlong is good. The person that came first was soloing a Shenlong list, but actually a lot of the list wasn't the monks. Actually, he had a Yasunori, Ivan Minako, and Ivan Ototo, and Kitty as well. So it was quite a hodgepodge sort of mix, maybe taking advantage of some other sort of synergies and situations. And it was just led by Shenlong. And I'm not sure about the person that came third. I'm pretty certain they weren't soloing Shenlong. So really, out of us three that were in the top four, we had quite a wide variety of masters being represented.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that just goes to show that, you know, we've got, as 10 Thunders players, we've got a lot to be drawing upon. You know, we've got lots of different masters that are good at different situations, and it doesn't all have to be about the one. It caused quite a lot of, conversation, I think, did the sort of solo Shenlong winning nationals, and there's been a lot of outcry about how broken he is, maybe he is a bit over the top, you know, maybe he's slightly above the power curve, but I'm a really big believer that most of Malifaux is about the skill of the player. So
yeah.
So maybe Shenlong will take two evenly matched players and slightly edge one above the other. But actually, you know, we're not really going to get to know that until we've put the reps in. We were talking about evidence before, you know, if it takes two and a half hours for a game, you know, we're talking 25 hours for 10 games, you know, the addition's only been out for, you know, for a comparatively short amount of time. Maybe we need to get the reps in before we start making like huge claims, you know. And there is likely, let's be realistic, there's likely to be imbalance and there's likely to be sort of little things that need tweaking. But maybe we just need to be a bit more rational about it and just a bit more patient about it.
I agree, Alex. And, you know, So two masters in Malifaux second edition. For those of you that are listening that didn't play Malifaux second edition, there was really two big moments where we saw problems, and they were with Sandeep in the Arcanist faction, and they were with Nicodem in the Resurrectionist faction. And there was a lot of talk, and both of those masters, by the way, needed attention. Don't get me wrong, but the talk was, you know, that they're too good. At some point, somebody's got to be good.
Someone's at the top of the curve, aren't they?
Exactly. But the problem with Nicodem and the problem with, oh my God, Sandeep, was that they were dominating the faction. So there was a period of time in 2E that if you were a competitive Arcanist player, it was really hard not to bring Sandeep, because there was no other masters there was no keywords back then, but no other masters in second edition, if you were an Arcanist, that could compete with Sandeep. So once he became the only real good choice in a competitive environment, that's when I thought he became a problem. And eventually that happened with Nicodem too. And I'm getting the feeling that we have no idea if that's true of Shenlong. The 10 Thunders has a lot of really good masters. I mean, if you listen to the McCabe deep dive, you know how good McCabe is. If you've ever played against McCabe, you know how good he is.
I think I'm a big proponent of all the 10 Thunders masters that aren't Shenlong.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think Alex's call is good. Now, Greg, I'd like to get your hot take on what we just talked about, but you also have done some interesting math with Chi that I think is worth talking about.
Yeah, sure. So it's just to kind of finish off the conversation you and Alex were having there, Shenlong may well be over the curve. And I agree with a lot of you, what you said. I think it's also worth mentioning that he exists in the game. And so complaining about it doesn't actually take that away. You know, if you go to a tournament, you know, this weekend, then Shenlong's there. All right. Well, your complaining hasn't done anything. And I think that if you immediately say something's broken, you kind of stop thinking about it. It's like, yeah, he's broken, whatever.
You shut down that thinking.
But actually, if you want to be successful competitively, exactly, he exists. You've got to be able to cope with him. You've got to think of some interesting strategies maybe to deal with Shenlong and what he's doing. And to take it back to your M2E thoughts there, Craig, regarding Nicodem, one of the things that kind of came out of that was, I think Jamie Ryan might have been the first guy to do it, actually, which is ironic given that he was the number one Nicodem player at the time. But actually was using Molly and Mortimer in an interesting way to drop a load of punk zombies right in Nicodem's face, right? Just pin him back to the board. So your Molly summoning isn't as good, but you're making a strong positional play, which is something that kind of is very much out of left field. A lot of players start to take Sue. So Sue, I think, was actually a book one model, maybe book two in M2E, which, you know, we're talking 4 or 5 years ago at least now, but who actually came right back to the forefront again, because he had the ability to just remove corpse markers without a resist flip targeting an enemy model. So you could target someone like Mortimer who's dropping all his corpse markers, and he suddenly, you know, poof, off they go. And so that requires a lot of, you know, going back to the drawing board.
And the negative cast aura.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And there's a phrase, I think, from writing, which is called murder your darlings, I think, which basically is you know, taking everything you find precious, everything you love, everything normal you do, you know, and saying, actually, like, none of this is working. I need to go back to the drawing board. I need to think of something new. Yeah. And yes, you may change. Yes, you may get errated. But for the moment, that's not going to help you this weekend. This weekend, you need a plan.
Wow, Greg, I don't know if I could have put it any better. That is a really, really good point. And you're 100% right that as soon as you say, oh, this is broken, you stop thinking, and that doesn't make him disappear. So that's an excellent point.
We did it with Zoraida, didn't we? You know, a couple of months ago, you know, Zoraida was the boogeyman, you know, and I don't know, maybe Shenlong's more powerful than Zoraida, we don't know. But at that time, you know, everyone was really struggling with her. And then we sort of go, actually, concealment's really good against her, because then it's that pressure on resources again, you know. I take two samurai with Train Ninja and put them right up in her face because, you know, because shooting's really good against her, you know, and like, you know, so pressure her straight away, you know, and people will find their answers maybe. And then, but if not, it'll come from the reps. It'll come from the, from the results. You know, this is one, I think maybe Swedish. Shen plays really well in the Swedish nationals, maybe. I don't know. There's probably been a couple of events, but it's not. But is it dominating yet?
Right.
And if it does dominate, well, then we'll do something about it.
Yep. Yep. And at that point, then, you know, Weird does something about it. And hell, I mean, it was Zoraida. And then before that, there was all there was talk about is Lynch. Was a week and a half on AWP about Lynch is overpowered. Yeah. And now I can't find a Lynch player if I try.
Yeah, I really don't rate him. I try playing him a lot, and he's not my cup of tea at all. I find him quite difficult to play. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, this was fantastic. Alex, it was great having you back. And Greg, I'm going to put you on the spot, man. We got to get you on again. I really enjoyed having you as a guest. Guys, for Alex, is there anything you want to plug?
Just that we all our henchmen in the UK, they're all amazing. Yeah. You've had two of them on the show, and they're brilliant. They're doing such a good job at keeping them, just growing the scene. They're brilliant.
Good dudes. How about you, Greg?
Yeah, sure. It's actually, I recognize that, we talk a lot about competitive play, and but tournaments are for everyone. And so one of my friends, Kieran, he three times a year, he runs an event called From Gotham to Sumeria. And it's basically, it's focused around not just Malifaux, but actually a lot of different kind of skirmish games.
It's fucking awesome.
Which Malifaux is probably like the most popular. basically it's just a load of people turning up to Element Games in Stockport, drinking beers, playing games. There's absolutely no organized play. If anything, that's probably the hallmark of the event. It's just, oh hey, you play, it's a Malifaux's most popular game, but people like say Bushido, for example, right? Or Dark Age, and all these other games I've never heard of, like, oh hey, you play this, and there may not be too many of those players in your meta, so you've come here and like, oh yeah, I'm going to play with Stranger, and it's an opportunity to travel, it's an opportunity to meet players outside of your meta, but without kind of the pressure of a tournament, without being forced to play three games, whether you want, not that you want to or not, but you know what I mean. It's you hang about all weekend. The next one is the 17th, 18th and 19th of January 2020. There's a Facebook event up. If you just search From Gotham to Sumeria, you should be able to find it.
I'll put a link in the show notes, Greg.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but yeah, it's really, really good fun weekend.
And we'll both be there, so you can come and have some games of foe against us.
That is true. We will both.
Well, yeah. What they can do is they can bring Shen Long and whoop your asses.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I'll think of that Shen Long plan.
All right, guys. That's funny. A real blast, gentlemen. I look forward to talking to you again. And for those of you listening, I appreciate you sticking around. Have a good night.
Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the U.S. Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
All right. Who wants to start off with second level play?
I don't think anything I do is good. I just play.
Yeah. Random question. You about talk about Qi and Shenlong and things.
Shenlong, is that some people have been talking about?
Yeah,
Shenlong?
Everyone's talking about Shenlong.
Yes, I'm going to talk about Shenlong. So when we get into the pool here, my first question for you guys is she just good in everything because of this flexibility?
No.
Okay, good. So
absolutely not. Yeah. Good.
Yeah, well, I guess reckoning she'd blow, right?
Yeah, she's not great. Yeah.
I'm randomly looking for a card very quickly now, so I don't get that wrong. Yeah, the 2-feature marker removed. There we go.
To your credit, Greg, you didn't know we were going to talk about Asami, so you didn't know to get the card out, right?
Yeah, I know. So professional, man.
The beauty of editing, yeah, Greg. I'll make you sound so smart.
Yeah. Well, we tell people to read their cards all the time, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure it's 2 per market, whatever. It's fine.